Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's good to have you with us. On today's show, Nikki Love and Hadi Dev will highlight the baby fair. We'll talk with Walt Hayes a little bit more about his charity work in Guatemala. Tom Matisse will outline heightened tsunami awareness. And we'll hear about Southeast Exchange 2017, an event that gathers science community professionals and educators to foster real-life experiences in our classrooms. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local, on a Juno afternoon, currently 48 degrees in an absolutely beautiful Juno sky.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that the records detailing the abuse of former Indian residential school survivors can eventually be destroyed. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the issue had set the privacy of individuals against preserving historical records.
Canada's highest court ruled in a unanimous decision that former residential school students will have 15 years to decide if they want to keep their personal stories preserved. The move puts the decision in the hands of those survivors, not government archivists. The court ruling means that the survivors have a right to keep the records private and have them destroyed. Phil Fontaine was at the forefront of the case. He's also a former national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Fontaine says the ruling was a good one.
It was a very clear statement on the rights of survivors, their consent. It is about their dignity. It is about their respect. And we're not gloating in any by any stretch. We're just very thankful that the Supreme Court of Canada came down on the right side in this case.
Native leaders had argued that not to uphold the rights of residential school survivors would be another breach of trust, in the same way that vulnerable people were abused at the schools when they were children. The government had argued that the records should be preserved to ensure what happened will never be forgotten. For more than 100 years, from the late 1880s, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were forced to attend the residential schools funded by the government and run by churches. Thousands were abused. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In Southeast Alaska, an early Tlingit village site listed in the National Register of Historic Places may be returned to its descendants. About 52 acres on Indian Point, owned by the city of Juneau, may be transferred to the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Jacob Resnick reports.
At the southernmost point of Auk Cape, a rocky outcropping offers sweeping views of Indian Cove and Indian Island. These names give away this area's history.
This is a south-facing waterfront lot with beautiful views of Auk Bay, which is the exact reason that the Native people selected it for their village site so many centuries ago.
Greg Cheney is a land manager for the city and borough of Juneau. The Cape Southern Tip has been city-owned since the 1960s.
It's very much like finding a wallet that somebody has. You pick it up on the street and you realize, oh, this belongs to somebody. And so then, you know, I think most people would agree the proper thing to do is to return it to the rightful owners.
A former Juneau assemblyman wrote to the assembly last month recommending that the city give Indian Point to the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Randy Wanamaker penned that letter.
We used to put branches in the water for the herring eggs and dip nets in the water and get the herring out. You know, so that was a practice that was going on for thousands of years.
Greg Cheney, the city lands manager, notes this is prime waterfront property, some of the most valuable holdings in the city's portfolio.
So that's why we have to be very careful about transferring it to an organization that's going to look out for the cultural interests of the Auk Quan and not, just look at it as a multi-million dollar asset.
In Auk Bay, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Students at the University of New Mexico were among those celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day Monday and raising awareness about Native issues. April Chi is president of the Kiva Club, a chartered Native student group on campus.
One of the biggest things is fracking and oil and protecting our sacred lands and protecting our sacred sites from outside big oil companies. Also, violence against women, that's something that we really are focusing on this semester as well.
Chi and other Kiva Club members say they're also advocating for university administration to enact the Indigenous Peoples Day holiday on campus. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by AARP. What we do might surprise you, like sponsoring the Alaska Federation of Natives in Anchorage, Alaska, October 19th through the 21st. Information at aarp.org.
Yate, support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions. Information on convention and tourism services at fiabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juno afternoon here on a beautiful Thursday, October 10th, 6 minutes after the hour. And joining me now in the studio.
At the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 19 hours.
Oh, that's interesting.
15 seconds. Universal time, 23 hours, 6 minutes, 20 seconds.
Let's see. That was coming in.
Naval Observatory. Daylight time,
Jeff, do you
19
know what that
hours,
is?
6 minutes, 30 seconds. Universal time, 23 hours, 6 minutes, 35 seconds.
Okay, stand by for a second.
At the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 19 hours, 6
you
minutes, 45 seconds.
Have a clock telling
seconds.
Me the time. It's coming in right there. Let's see here. Okay, let's give it a try now. I have a couple folks here in the studio. We're going to be talking about the baby fair. We have Nikki Love and also Hottie Dev. Welcome to the show, you two.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, we just had the world, I don't know, could you hear it? We had the world clock telling us what time it was from
the
ether. So anyway, it is indeed 7 minutes after the hour. The baby fair, however, is happening Thursday, October 12th from 4 to 6 p.m. At the Valley Public Library. And why don't we start with you, Nikki? I know AEYC, you're the community engagement coordinator for them, is a big part of this. Tell us about AEYC. Let's start with AEYC.
Yeah, AEYC is the Association for the Education of Young Children, and we are working with families and child care providers in town trying to increase the access to quality child care for folks, also increase information about child development. And we work with a number of partner agencies through a group called the Partnerships for Families and Children. And the Baby Fair is a project that they do every year. This is, in fact, the third Baby Fair that's happening on Thursday. And it's a chance where all the partners come together, meet the public, meet families. And families can come if they're expecting children, if they want to have children, if they have little ones between ages 0 to 2, that's who it's especially for. There's lots of information about finding childcare, signing up your children on Imagination Library, and, you know, safe sleep practices, family-friendly activities. And one of the biggest benefits, I think, for this are the free vision and hearing screenings and also the free flu immunizations for young ones.
And that's where you come in, right, Hottie, and the Lions Club?
Right. We've been doing service work around vision since 1923, and we have this little camera that we can point at kids, and it takes a 3D picture of their eyes and sends it into a computer and then gives us a readout, and it helps well, children can't talk for themselves. It helps you understand what they're seeing.
And again, you said this is really focused on ages 0 to 2. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you are expecting a baby, we'd love to meet you. If your children are a little bit older, you're welcome to come. But do know, if you have a child like between the age of 3 and 5, we have another fair. It's an early learning fair, and that happens in the spring. So
okay.
You don't have to come to this one.
Hottie, tell us about the Lions Club and vision. Why did the Lions Club choose to take that on?
Well, the Lions Club started in 1917, and I don't know what they did before that, but Helen Keller met with the leaders of the Lions Club in 1923 and asked them to take this as one of their missions, and they took it as their primary mission.
Okay. All right, so we'll have the vision testing. You also said hearing testing. Is that right, Nikki?
That's right. Our parents' as teachers staff will be doing hearing testing for children, and it's great. Both of these screenings are really important to do at an early age because it can identify, issues that might be present. And if those issues can be addressed earlier, then children are able to develop typically and learn and engage with the world in a much healthier way. Oftentimes, these things aren't caught until a child gets to school, and then they're already delayed, and they have a lot of catching up to do.
How do you test a 1 or 2 year old for hearing?
Well, they have a little machine called an OAE, I think. I've seen it, and it's a little thing that goes in their ears, and it's really quick, and I think the kids they're not bothered by it. I think it's similar to maybe what we use, but I really couldn't tell you. I'm sorry.
No problem. So vision, hearing, what else is going to be at the fair?
Free flu immunizations brought to us by our friends at the Juneau Public Health Center, and then lots of information about child development and like family-friendly activities. If a family has a baby, and that's when you have an infant in your life, your world really becomes focused on that baby, and it's focused in the house, and you may not be reaching out to the community as much. And this is a great place to come to meet other families, to find out what else is going on around town. Like every month, there is the family night at the turf that happens out at the turf field in the valley. And it's a really wonderful free-form opportunity to come meet families, play with toys and materials, things like that. So this fair will be great to make those connections as well.
I've been hearing a lot about challenges with sort of pre-K childcare. Is that something that you'll be discussing at this fair on Thursday?
We do, yes, we will be discussing that. One of our partners, THRED, the Alaska Childcare Resource and Referral Group, they have an online search tool for all licensed programs in the area, and we will have that accessible, and we often talk to families about the lack of care in Juneau, and that's not a new thing, unfortunately. So we do some creative brainstorming with folks how they can maybe share or offset, their work schedules to take care of the baby, make like a network of folks who we know a lot of folks who share care among friends, or we will help you become a licensed childcare provider. So it can really be a rewarding career. And it could start at this baby fair.
And can either of you please speak to this a little bit? But I've been hearing more and more just about, and maybe it's obvious, how formative age zero up through, pre-K is, and how important home care and reading and taking care of our young ones is. Can you speak to that and maybe why it seems like it's becoming more in the forefront?
Yeah, I can't give you the best data and numbers. Some of my cohorts really can, but what I understand is, over the past 15 or 20 years, there's really been an increase in the studies and the knowledge around brain development in utero and in the early years. And they have found that the connections and the development of a child's brain between ages 0 to 3, I believe, is the greatest it will ever be in their life. So they're putting everything together. They're making sense of their world. They're experiencing things for the first time and defining, what life is about. And mastering all of these new skills. And so having a quality learning environment, which can be at home, it could be in a center, it's with your family, it's with friends, but having, rich and engaging activities, and you mentioned reading, there will be folks helping people sign up for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. And what that program does is gets a book into the hands of children every month. It's mailed to their home, and it's age appropriate. And Dolly Parton had, it's one of her missions.
We have hundreds of her books.
Oh, yeah. They're so good.
We have 4 grandchildren. We have hundreds of their books.
But what she had found is that if a child approaches an adult and says, "Would you read to me?" that's going to happen. Adults respond to that. And then you're not only gaining those literacy skills, but you're gaining those social skills, that together time, you know, that acknowledgement that this child is important, that these relationships are important. You know, they're learning to sit. They're learning to pay attention. I mean, and also they're learning their letters, numbers, sentence structure, things like that.
Seems like the perfect activity,
it
really.
Is. Yeah.
All right. So learn more this Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Valley Public Library. The Baby Fair, the Lions Club will be there doing vision screening.
We'll be there. Adding it to our numbers, we do about 2,000 vision screenings in Southeast Alaska.
Wow.
And there's a lady in Anchorage, a lion in Anchorage, and she runs a group that does around 20,000 screenings.
Wow. Wow. And a host of other affiliates will be there as
yes.
well.
And if they would like to find out more about the partnerships or more about the event, they can call us at AEYC or they can get onto the website at junofamilies.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Nikki Love and Hadi Dev. I appreciate it. Anything else either of you would like to add?
No, we just hope to see you there.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, you too.
Clean Harbors invites boating locals to help keep our waters clean and our wildlife healthy by using pump outs, scooping your pup's poop, and putting waste in its proper place. Find out more and get a free pump out adapter for your boat at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message brought to you with funding from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service Clean Vessel Act through the Alaska Clean Water Actions Program.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 10th. It's 20 minutes past the top of the hour. And in the studio with me is Walt Hayes. You may remember him from yesterday. He was on the show, but we got cut short. So we asked him back here today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about his presentation at the Downtown Library from 5 to 7 tonight. And it all revolves around this work in Guatemala with a lot of support here in Juno and around the state. Walt, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
It's nice to have you here. For people that weren't with us yesterday, can you sort of outline your project for them?
Yeah, I'd sort of like to say a word about the signs of the times. I think what's happening today in our society is there's a tremendous emphasis on volunteerism. This past year, 5 million people, 6 million in fact, were involved in some sort of volunteer activity. Might have been with Habitat for Humanity. It might have been with a group doing a dig in Wales for an archaeological site. It might have been with a hunger project. It might have been Lions going out on a vision mission. But our society is placing a great emphasis on that because of our baby boomers. We're having a longer retirement period in our lives. And there's a great emphasis now among young people on the area of service learning. Kids are taking gap years after high school and college to sort of taste the world and get some broader experience before deciding on a life's work. I was very interested to see that young people from Thunder Mountain here in Juneau are going to be going to Nepal to work building schools and houses. What a marvelous opportunity. Those kids, after that experience, 25, 30 years now, will be talking about the weeks I spent in Nepal. Sure. And I think what inevitably they will say, I really came back knowing how lucky I am. My.
So, well, you're associated with the Lions Club.
Indeed I am.
What drew you to volunteerism?
Well, I was fortunate enough to retire early. I've been retired since 2000, and I'm kind of an activist. And my background with the church and in development with quite a few nonprofit agencies, I had a skill set that I thought might be helpful. And so I started by delivering carts for the handicapped in Guatemala on three trips over a period of 4 years, and then in 2013, 2015, and 2017, my wife and I led teams to Guatemala to try to make a difference.
And if I may ask, why Guatemala? How did you find that country?
Well, Guatemala is kind of a basket case. It's the classic banana republic. We've been involved as a government, not as honorifically as I would like, in terms of our support of the military junta and also the capitalism, which really made it a vassal of the United Fruit Company. Guatemala has 17 million people. 40% of them are Mayan, which are grossly underserved. And the thing that blows you away when you travel there is that 1% of the population owns 65% of all the resources. Mm-hmm. 1%. There are 14% of the Guatemalan population living on less than a dollar and a half a day.
Wow.
I come back from that kind of trip, and I tell my friends, I think I've won the lottery. I was 80 this summer while I was in Guatemala, and luckily, I have a decent home. I have money in the bank. I have a wife who loves me. I have six grandkids and two great-grandkids. But if I were an 80-year-old Mayan man in Guatemala, I would have no pension, no Social Security, probably no savings, no health care, no safety nets, and I probably still have a hole over my shoulder going out, if I could, to hoe corn and beans to help feed the extended family. So there's a great disparity in the world. We can look at videos, we can read books, we can see documentaries, but till you've been there, seen the people who are struggling and trying to have a life, it really comes home to you.
So you are sort of having a second career in volunteerism, it seems to me.
Indeed. Yeah. I've been very active with Lions. And Lions were a big part of our work in Guatemala. We tackled multiple projects this past summer. We provided four rural health clinics with two young health professionals here from Juneau, Dr. Blaise Bellows and Sarah Sonstadt. They served 180 patients. We helped rehab a fire station. We vision screened as Lions about 600 kids and adults. We provided 300 pairs of prescription glasses and another 480 pairs of readers to adults, elders. And it was so well received. And one of the best things we did, and where the women of Juneau are involved, was to provide these marvelous feminine hygiene kits called Days for Girls. It's reusable. It's appropriate. It gives young girls who have come of age and are now menstruating the opportunity to have poise and dignity, a chance to take care of themselves. And what's happened across the world as this movement has grown, there are now, it's all volunteer driven. There are now 540,000 of these kits in 100 nations. And when they are distributed to girls and girls have the self-confidence and can take care of their basic health needs, absenteeism just plummets. It went from 36% to 8% in Uganda, for example. Girls stay in school. And we know, I think those of us who are great grandpas, that educated girls are the future of the world. Women do things differently. They network. They tend to their families. They tend to their communities. And this is what makes a strong community and a strong society. We were fortunate here to have women from Northern Light United Church, from the Capital City Quilters, making these Days for Girls kits. And we distributed 440 of them in Guatemala. The girls were appreciative. Their moms were appreciative. Their aunts hugged me. Thank you for caring for our girls. The teachers loved it. And even we had a lot of people here, Anne Marie Martin, and even Girl Scouts in Juneau were making these kits. And it's so encouraging to let people know you care and to actually see their gratitude. This is so basic and so fundamental to their well-being. And this distribution went along with a basic lecture of the facts of life about a woman maturing and how you take care of this basic health need. And I just am so impressed with the women of Alaska. We had women in 12 different communities making these bags. It was just thrilling.
That's great. So tonight from 5 to 7 at the Downtown Library, you're going to be presenting about this experience. Is that right? And will there be opportunities for people who want to get involved? Would this be a good way to come meet you and find out how to become involved?
Indeed. I'll be doing a short PowerPoint, which is an overview of the work in Guatemala. We're going to make a special pitch about Days for Girls because it's the kind of thing you don't have to be a seamstress to help. You could write a check. You could help shop for the materials. It's an assembly line process. It takes about 6-7 hours to make a bag, but it'll last 2 to 3 years. And what a difference it makes in the life of a little girl whose mom and dad may be living on $3 to $5 a day. And they just do not have the money to provide her with disposable sanitary products. That just isn't an option like it is for our kids. So it's one of the best things we can do. And it's non-sectarian. They are distributed according to need. We work with schools and clinics and hospitals and communities. And they're right now, as I was saying earlier before we came on air, we have a request in Anchorage when they learned about our success. People are going to Kenya and Uganda this January and March and want 300 kits because there's such a need for this.
So it sounds like you can use physical volunteers to help assemble the kits. We can always use financial contributions, right, towards
Indeed.
Something like this.
And we have some handouts tonight. We'll be outlining that. But it's just such a wonderful, practical, doable project to really make the difference. When you think of what it means when a girl is going to a woman 3,000 times, they will face the monthly issue. But for a girl to miss that much school, when she misses 5 days at a time every month, 4 or 5 days, what a tremendous blessing this is. She can stay in school, and it's just having tremendous impact all over the world.
So, Walt, you said in 2000 you retired?
Yes.
Imagine back in 2000 had you not found volunteerism, and maybe this is a pitch to people who are thinking about dedicating themselves to some sort of volunteerism. What would your life be like had you not found it?
Well, you know, I could have been found other things to do, but what it does, it gives you the opportunity to give back. I've been blessed, and it gives me an opportunity to give back, not only in Alaska and some projects, but also in the developing world. Melvin Jones, the founder of Alliance back in 1917, was a prosperous insurance executive, and he and a group of men would meet round table every week for luncheon, and, you know, I buy my cars from you, and you're my insurance man, and you're the banker, and it was all hail fellow well met. And Melvin Jones says, you know, there has to be more to life than this. He said, you know, life really doesn't mean anything unless you can help another person. And the funniest thing, the first thing these club did in Chicago in 1917, right after the war, they took their resources. These were prosperous men. And they built brick privies in the tenement slums for public sanitation. And then, as your previous guest mentioned, in 1925, Helen Keller challenged Lyons to be the Knights of the Blind, and we have done that among many things, and we now have restored sight to 30 million people worldwide. We operate 640 eye hospitals and clinics.
Okay. Meet Walt tonight from 5 to 7 at the Downtown Library and his associates, and learn more about how you can help. Downtown Library, 5 to 7. Walt Hayes, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Not really, except to say if you get a chance to be involved in volunteerism, whether it's at home or if it's on a trip like some of us have taken, you know, run, don't walk. Take advantage of that, because you will be a better person. You are the one that will be blessed when you come back and know that you've been able in some way to make a contribution to the well-being of your brothers and sisters around the world.
Thank you, Walt.
Love. broadcast is sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Serving Juneau since 1978, Ron's Apothecary is providing medication information, nutritional supplements, and homeopathic remedies. More information at ronsapothecary.com.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon on Tuesday, October 10th. Scott Burton, your host today. It's about 25 minutes until the top of the hour. In the studio now is Tom Matisse. He's the Emergency Programs Manager for the City and Borough of Juneau. And we're going to be talking about tsunami awareness today. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you here. Tell us, before we focus in on tsunami, as emergency programs manager, what's your job look like?
Well, I work directly for the city manager, kind of between the police chief and the fire chief, write all the emergency response plans for the city, and I'm the city's liaison to all the state and federal agencies. So when it comes to natural hazards kind of events, the suicide basin stuff, the avalanche stuff, tsunamis, working with the weather service, that's kind of the stuff I focus on to help support the city.
Okay. Speaking of tsunamis, I understand some new reports just came out.
Yeah, we've got some new reports that have been developed by the University of Alaska Fairbanks in conjunction with several other agencies, talking about both a distant offshore tectonic earthquake-related tsunamis and local inshore submarine landslide-generated tsunamis, which is all new to Juneau here, that kind of concept.
All right. What are a few highlights from those reports?
Well, you know, we have always known that we've had the ability to have tsunamis affect Juneau. During the 64 quake, we had about a 4-foot tide change. The new models show that in a worst-case scenario, which is actually double the magnitude of a 64 quake, it looks like we could have a theoretical 6 to 10-foot run-up. And obviously in Juneau with 20-foot tides, the state of the tide on that day makes a huge difference too, right? Whether it's a full high flood tide or whether it's low tide, because a 10-foot run-up up at low tide doesn't mean much to us.
Yeah, right. So we're sitting here pretty much at sea level, right?
Mm-hmm.
K2 Studios. If it were mean tide, let's say, and we had a 10-foot this, and by the way, you were telling me before we came on the air, these are some real worst-case scenarios,
these
right?
These are worst-case scenarios. You know, thousands of years of history of the Earth. They state that these are possible, but This is about as far as they can push the model. So we can assume that if we evacuate those areas, we should not have any other danger.
Okay, well, let's take it worst case, super high tide and 10 feet of water. What's that look like here in our area?
You know, in downtown, actually, we don't see that much run-up. And over time, things continue to change. Remember, we have glacier rebound here, too, so our threat gets less and less. Over decade after decade, it gets slightly reduced. So we're a little bit fortunate.
Where does it look the most alarming in our community?
You know, you're going to see stuff out in Ock Bay. You're going to see stuff here in downtown, around the airport area. It just really depends.
Okay. What does it mean for us sort of being inland here in the fjords rather than outer coast?
So we're very fortunate in the islands tend to be a breaker for the tsunamis. We don't see the big tsunamis that Valdez or Cordova could see from distant tsunamis. We're not going to see those offshore tsunamis come through the islands and have a 20-foot run-up here in Juneau. They slow down the change in water effect, and they slow down the raise in the water. So they act like giant breaking mounds for an avalanche, if you will. They divert the flow and slow it down and make it a lot smaller event. So we're very fortunate to be this far inland.
I guess the flip side of that could be, I know they're very sort of anomalous, but like a Lituya Bay style, tsunami where it's caused by a landslide?
Right. There's landslide-generated tsunamis both above water landslides and below water landslides. The new study focuses on submarine landslide tsunamis. They didn't really have a way to generate models for an above-ground tsunami Lituya Bay style. And as you guys know, a little history for you, Lituya Bay had a 1,760-foot run-up, which means the top of the tram would have been 40 feet out of the water. So even if we could model those, there's probably not much safe place to be in Juneau. But the interesting thing is the underwater submarine landslides. They talk about our moraine environments coming from glaciers into our deep channels in the fjords here, how the river mouths deposit a lot of silt and debris, and how those river mouths have the ability to slump or have underwater landslides into the deeper channels, causing those inshore tsunamis. So, for example, the mouth of the Mendenhall River going into Fritz Cove with deep water in Fritz Cove. They've used events like Valdez, Cordova, other historic submarine landslides to generate these models. But they said in a worst-case scenario in Fritz Cove, for example, you could have 40 to 50-foot run-up in that area. And it's definitely an isolated area. That run-up doesn't continue all the way into downtown, and it doesn't continue out to Eagle Beach. But in a near environment, it has potential to be a catastrophic event.
Okay. What kind of earthquake should we be worried about? I know we just talked about some slides, but usually slides are caused by earthquakes often. What kind of earthquake should we be worried about?
You know, the biggest thing to recognize for the inshore submarine landslides is there's really no way for the tsunami warning system to work, and there's no way for us to use the emergency alert system to let people know. So people need to get into their thought process that if there's an earthquake that's longer than 20 seconds, if it's hard to stand up, if it's big enough to knock you down, seek higher ground. You should look at the new maps. People, there are maps available on the city's website for both the offshore tsunami and for the inshore tsunami. The inshore tsunami evacuation zone is quite a bit bigger than an offshore tsunami zone. You should know where that is. And if there's a big earthquake, big enough to knock you off your feet, feel free to seek higher ground. If nothing happens in 20 minutes, these are going to be non-events. We have earthquakes all the time. They're typically non-events. But in Skagway, they've had underwater landslide tsunamis that have caused damage and have affected. So we do have that potential. We need people to be aware of that potential, and we need people to be educated and take it upon themselves to make the decision to evacuate.
What about buildings? Here we are on the second floor in Studio A at K2 Public Media. Would we be safe up here on the second floor?
Well, once again, here in this location we are, when you start looking at, you know, the difference between that offshore tsunami and the inshore tsunami, the Ok Bay area is far more affected than downtown. And once again, that inshore tsunami is more affected by those localized environments. For example, if you were right off the mouth of the Taku River and that slumped, or if you were right off Fritz Cove and that slumped, those are going to have the biggest catastrophic concerns.
And so... let's say second story in a building in Ok Bay. Sorry, I'm just nitpicking.
No, that's okay. You know, I have a friend who saw the maps, and he said, how could this be? My house is 80 feet above sea level, and it shows my backyard in a tsunami zone. I said, well, there's 60-something, 50-something feet of run-up right into your backyard. So.
Got it. And so it sounds like people should really go to the website and look at these maps.
There are new maps. There are definitely worst-case scenarios, but it's a great educational tool. Anybody who's concerned with the possibility of a tsunami and wants to know where safe areas are, those maps will show you worst-case scenarios. And if you're not anywhere in the red, you're in a good place.
Okay. Sorry, last question. Here we are at 20 seconds right now. You and I can barely stand up here in the studio. I know we're in kind of a safe zone. What would we do?
So we're in a relatively safe environment here in the studio on the second floor. If the building didn't collapse, I'd probably stay right where I'm at.
Okay.
If I was somewhere else in town or if I was on the first floor, I would just start walking towards the hill, walk up the Capitol.
Walk, not run.
Walk, not run. Walk, not drive. You don't have time to get in your car and go somewhere. And what if you get in your car and you hit a red light or there's a traffic jam? Feel free to leave your house and walk to high ground as quick as you can.
All right. If people want more information, how can they get it? If they want to talk to you, maybe.
You can always give me a call at my office. It's 586-0419. And on the Juno website at juno.org, there's maps available in the geophysical hazards map file. So if you Google Juno geophysical hazards, the maps pop right up.
Okay. Tom Matisse, he's the emergency programs manager for CBJ. Tom, is there anything we're missing? Anything you want to add?
No, it's just really important to recognize, you guys, we don't have catastrophic earthquake potential here, but when we do see big ones, people need to take that evacuation protocol on their own. If it's big enough to knock you down, seek higher ground.
Thanks, Tom.
Have a great day.
More than 24 species of gulls living in North America. Some people might dismiss them as just seagulls, but not the people of Port Orchard, a small town on Washington's Puget Sound. In Port Orchard, gulls are celebrated. Each year, hundreds of people gather at the town's waterfront in late May for the annual Seagull Calling Festival. Contestants, most of them in grade school, chirp, caw, and flap their way down the beach. The town's mascot is Seymour the Seagull. He's at the festival, too. Organizers say they respect the ecological niche gulls fill, and it's just fun for the kids. The gulls along the beach definitely look amused. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note comes from Bloomsbury, a publisher of natural history books and birding guides. Critical Critters by Ralph Steadman and Carrie Levy is available now.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 10th, about 12 minutes till the top of the hour. In the studio now is Jess Cobley. She is a 7th grade science teacher at Floyd Dryden Middle School. And we're going to be talking about an event coming up here a week from today that gets professionals, scientists, together with educators and students. Sounds very cool. Welcome to the show, Jess.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right. So this is called the Southeast Exchange 2017, next Tuesday at the Jack from 5 to 7. What's sort of the purpose of this meeting?
Yeah, so this event came about kind of early last year. A couple of us came together from the Juno STEM Coalition, JEDC, and the school district because we thought it'd be great to just create a place where local people could come in and talk with educators so that we could connect them in the classroom just kind of more easily. Our goal is to connect those STEM professionals right now. So science, technology, engineering, and math is who we're geared toward with pre-K through 12 educators.
Okay. As an example, what are you teaching right now in seventh grade?
Yeah, so I'm teaching in seventh grade, we're learning about cells, and we're just wrapping up photosynthesis and respiration.
And would that be helpful for you to have somebody from the community come in and share their work?
Yeah, I think it's always helpful for the kids to get a chance to see how what they're learning is being used in real life. So, yeah, if there was a biologist that could come in and talk about plants or someone from the genetic side to come in and talk about the genetics behind cells and heredity and things, it would be really great for the kids to just extend what they're learning beyond the walls of the classroom.
It seems to me like local businesses or government organizations would love to support that as well, right, and get their employees out into the classroom.
Yeah, and I think for me, I lived in upstate New York, a larger community than Juneau, and moving here just last year, it's been pretty just cool for me to see how quickly and how many people from the local community have jumped out to help support the event already.
And so this event is essentially a networking event?
Yes, correct. So we want to connect professionals and educators to help teachers kind of integrate the real-life experiences into the classroom for our Juneau kids.
Probably a kind of a big question, but off the top of your head, what are some of the professionals that you think you could use most in the classroom?
Sure. So on our list, we're kind of looking for a large range. We're hoping to open up away from science next year, but this year we're really geared towards those STEM subjects. So people who use science, technology, engineering, and math in their daily work or have it in their job title, or even if they have a less formal way of understanding and working with STEM. So that could be like carpenters, scientists, electricians, photographers. And we also really want to open it up for culture bearers who can help convey the Alaska Native understanding so that we include the Western science and kind of those other ways of knowing, just bringing those together in the classroom.
Okay, so this is going to be a week from today, 5 to 7, at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. What can people expect?
Sure. So at the event, we're just really excited to offer quite a few things. First off, we've got Meet and Geek Bingo, so you can walk in and kind of get some free food and drinks and mingle while we get started. And then we're going to hopefully give you the chance to learn from successful and some not-so-successful examples of school and community collaborations. And then we will spend time to brainstorm, kind of like speed dating between the scientists and the educators, about how to create hands-on, place-based, and engaging lessons for our kids. And then at the end, we're walking away with a new database, so we'll have each scientist and teacher hopefully sign in and give their information to a database that will be searchable after the event so that teachers can go back and you know, find that person they talked to, have their contact information and what they wanted to share or talk about in the classrooms.
Where will this database live first so teachers can visit it?
Sure. So we're trying to figure that out right now, but hopefully it will be linked to our website, Southeast Exchange, which will be on flyers and made available on the school district and sent out in emails. But the database will be housed in the Southeast Exchange website and on the Juneau STEM Coalition website as well.
Okay. What's your next subject after cells? In your classroom?
Our next subject is the human body, which is my favorite.
And, interesting.
So kids
nurses,
are...
Nurses, doctors?
Yeah, for sure. Yep, learning all about the different systems and the kids' hormones are raging in seventh grade, so it's always a fun topic to go over.
Okay. 5 to 7 at the Jack, a week from today, the Southeast Exchange putting teachers, students, and professionals together to make education more interesting and fun.
Yeah.
Jess Cobley, she's a seventh grade teacher out at Floyd Dryden Middle School. Thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything I'm missing or that you'd like to add?
Thanks so much. I think I'll just add in at the end that we've had we'll have free food and drinks, door prizes, stickers, and some glasses with our logo. And then we've had Alaska Zipline Adventures donate some tours along with Wings Airways. So we've got some pretty great prizes to give out to teachers. And, yeah, we really need the community members and teachers to come out to make it successful, just to continue helping show our kids that what they're learning in the classroom extends beyond the classroom.
All right, Jess, we'll see you 5 to 7 at the Jack a week from today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thought I heard voices.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, Shelley Delaney will be your host. And we will hear about upcoming Family History Days, learn how small businesses can interact with the Forest Service, and Joanne Flora from REACH will highlight Disability Employment Awareness Month. And Annie Bartholomew will talk about Friday the 13th KXLL activities. Taking a look at the weather here in the capital city, it's currently 48 degrees under a beautiful fall sky. Tonight calls for isolated showers after 1 a.m. And Wednesday, isolated showers before 10 a.m., cloudy through mid-morning, then gradually clearing with a high around 49. Chance of precip is 20% there in the morning. On Thursday, sunny with a high near 45. Northeast winds around 5 miles per hour. And on Friday, it calls for showers mainly after 10 a.m. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.